The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey. Welcome again to Inside Medicine. We have a fantastic guest. Her name is Dr. Josette Bradshaw. Josette is one of the premier family doctors in Southern Jersey. She's got a lot of pep, a lot of verve, is very, very an individual who can get patients to do the right thing, which is important. She will be with us in a few minutes. I want to open up just with a few points of interest. Is walking better or running? Walking beats sitting or not walking. It reduces the risk of many health problems, including anxiety, depression, diabetes, and some cancers. But once conditioned to brisk extended walks, if you can coax even part of your walk into a run, it produces the same physical and mental benefits in far less time. Running requires more energy and power than walking, so your heart and lungs work harder. Studies suggest that moderate versus light activity strengthens your heart and creates new mitochondria. Mitochondria are the power centers of your cells, which produce fuel for your muscles. It also dramatically increases VO2 max, which the runners like to talk about, a measure of how much oxygen a body can process and a key indicator of longevity. So get that walk in, but do a little running, a key indicator of longevity. Another item that has caught my eye from Investor's Business Daily this morning, a smart but threatening sky. Drone aircraft piloted by artificial intelligence will soon have the agency to find and destroy targets without human oversight. Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks announced this summer that the U.S. military will, quote, field attributable autonomous systems at scale of multiple thousands, end quote, in the coming 2 years. The push to compete with China's rapidly advancing weapons requires that the U.S., quote, leverage platforms that are small, smart, cheap, and many, end quote, Hicks said. That in turn has led to a push at the United Nations for legally binding rules on the use of such lethal autonomous weapons. The UN is providing a forum, but binding rules are not likely, the Times reported. The U.S., Russia, Australia, and Israel are among those arguing that no international law is necessary. What is the world coming to? I just want to point out what the definition of agency is, a relationship between principal and an agent in which the principal confers or gives rights to the agent on the principal's behalf. So in other words, you have machines getting into the action. Another interesting article this week, called Dance Through the Fire from Michael Minnick. Michael indicates that it's not a matter of how smart you are. Success comes down to the quality of the decisions you make, especially under pressure. Note, especially under pressure. Advice from others can help you make great decisions, but you must actively listen and absorb what you are hearing. Consistently questioning if there is a better way to do something is a pillar of good decision-making. Finally, when making decisions, remember that it doesn't matter how smart you are. Success comes down to the quality of your decisions you make, especially under pressure. And that's Michael Mink and Investor's Business Daily this weekend. Let me now introduce Josette Palmer. Josette is a phenomenal young family doctor. She practices in South Jersey. She basically can make sure that she's motivates her patients to do the right thing. She makes good decisions, and she's an asset to the South Jersey community. Josette, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Fallon. Thank you very much for the intro, and thank you for correcting the last name.
Okay, thank you. So let's see. Let me just start off, because you're in the business of seeing many patients and have to get the job done. Which vaccines do I need at this time if I am a patient of yours?
Well, this is the time of year where people should be getting their flu shots. I would put flu shot as the number one vaccine to get at this time of the year. Best time to get it is between September and November. I try to encourage my patients to have their flu vaccine by December. But if someone comes into me in December or January and they still want the flu vaccine, I'll still give it to them. But the prime time to get it is now, because you want to be protected for flu season. And that's usually between December and usually March, sometimes April. Occasionally we've had flu be around a little bit longer into the early to the late spring, but this is the prime time to get it so you can be protected. And again, getting a vaccine doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to get the disease. It means it's going to lessen your chances of getting severe disease, because especially for the really young or the older population or people who have different illnesses like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, they're the ones that are really at risk for getting severe disease, so you want them to be protected. But even someone who doesn't have any diseases at all, the flu can be pretty severe. It can cause pneumonia and can put some patients in the hospital and can actually be life-threatening. So even if you're a young, healthy person, you should still get your flu vaccine. The other vaccines that you should think about are the COVID vaccine. There is a new booster that's been out since September, so I would look into getting that. If you're over the age of 50, then there's the shingles vaccine, and that's a series of two shots, and you can get that at any time of the year. So there's no right or wrong time to get it, except for if you're over the age of 50 and you have not had your shingles vaccines, I would get that. Again, that's two shots. And that is something that can be given at any time of the year. There's also pneumonia vaccines out, and there's a few different pneumonia vaccines out now. Pneumonia vaccine was more important for people over the age of 65, but if you have different medical conditions, some of those that I previously mentioned, then you should get, you are a candidate for the pneumonia vaccine. And believe it or not, it's even important for people who smoke, because they're more at risk of getting pneumonia because of the way that smoking can affect their lungs. So the flu, COVID, shingles, pneumonia, pretty much, you know, definitely flu and COVID at this time, but shingles and pneumonia, and then you always want to make sure that your tetanus is up to date, and that's every 10 years, unless there's other circumstances.
What about this respiratory syncytial virus vaccine? Any input on that?
So RSV was primarily a infant disease. So that was something that we worried about, and more so the premature infants, not necessarily as much the healthy infants, although they are at risk. But we're starting to see it more so in the adult population, and can affect the older adults more, just like flu can affect the older adults more, pneumonia can affect the older adults more. I will admit, I don't see it as much. I'm starting to see more of it. So when patients ask me, hey, should I get that new RSV vaccine? Because they can't help but see it's advertised. Whenever the pharmaceutical industry wants you to see something, it's all over the TV. So they're all asking about this RSV vaccine. And it's been out they've been administering it for the last few months. That I do say that if they have lung disease, heart disease, then that's a vaccine that I would get. They are promoting it more so 60 and up. Will that change in the future? It might. Shingles vaccine used to be 60 and up, and then they moved that to 50. So will they move RSV to 50 and up? That's possible. They're always looking at different statistics to see which diseases are affecting which populations more with different severity. So, yes, RSV vaccine is a newer one, new kid on the block, you could say, and that one's been out probably for about the last few months, and that's a one and done for right now.
So Dr. Josette, shingles, does that require two vaccines? Is that correct? And what is the efficacy of that shingles vaccine?
So years ago, there was a one-and-done Zostavax. And that vaccine was out a while ago, and it was the one and only at that particular time for shingles. Then came Shingrix, which is a two-shot deal. And that has a much greater efficacy than the one Zostavax. So if 10 years ago you got a shingles vaccine, it definitely was not Shingrix. It was the one-and-done Zostavax. And do you still need another vaccine? Yes, you do. So if you got the Zostavax 10 years ago, then yes, you should have the Shingrix, the new shingles vaccine out now. And that's a two-shot series. And again, I've had patients who've had the shingles vaccine. They've had the two-shot series. And a matter of fact, this one just came in within the last month, and he did get shingles. But he didn't have the pain, and he did not have the rash to any great degree. And he also has cancer, so cancer changes your immune system. So even though he did have the two-shot deal, he did have shingles, but it was a very mild case, and he had no pain at all. Because that's what, with shingles, the rash is one thing, but the pain that you get after the rash, that is the problem child, because that can last for many years.
So, Josette, that idea that you just developed, that the original shingles vaccine probably had about a 50% efficacy, and I remember calling up ID doctors and saying, should I recommend that to my patients? And I would say the majority of ID doctors said no, because they didn't like that 50% efficacy, whereas this new one, isn't it over 90% effective and incredibly better?
Yes, it is a lot more effective and incredibly better. That's a great little term, but okay, incredibly better. Yes, it is incredibly better. So I would recommend it. Now, something that you have to look at is when you're getting the shingles vaccine, a lot of people will come into me and they'll say, hey, can you give me that shingles vaccine? If they are on Medicare, then they have to go to their pharmacy to get that vaccine, because there's an arrangement with the pharmacies and the government in regards to Medicare patients. It's not a lot of, most times you cannot get that vaccine from your doctor's office. You have to get that from the pharmacy, but it is widely available.
Okay. Well, that I can say that it drives me crazy when the government does such a thing, take something away from a family doctor. And sometimes
exactly.
It's the only opportunity you'll see your patient for that year. So again, I think the government made a mistake on that by deep-sixing the family doctor. Welcome to America.
I agree. That's
let me just
right.
Move on
That's how we do.
let me just move that on a little bit. Most importantly in society is pregnant women. Why do pregnant women need whooping cough shot? To me, is that a big deal?
It has become a big deal because the immunity that we receive when we were getting our series when we were children, that does not last. Just like you see in the state of New Jersey, sixth graders need that shot, the Tdap. That's the tetanus with the pertussis. So pertussis is the whooping cough. So that's given at age 11 or sixth grade, and that's a requirement. So that immunity does not last forever. So when you're pregnant, then we need the baby to be protected. And it's not as much for the baby to be protected in utero while the mom is carrying the baby, but more so when the child is born. So it's not something that you want to wait and get when you're in the hospital delivering the baby. And I've seen that done sometimes, and it's kind of silly to me because it still takes a couple weeks for the mom's immunity to be up. So even if the mom is breastfeeding the baby's not getting that immunity, at least for the first couple of weeks. So the mom should be vaccinated, and that can be done after the first trimester. And then when she's vaccinated, the father should also be vaccinated because he's going to be around the child. And then any adults, grandparents, great-grandparents. I had a 96-year-old great-grandparent-to-be, and she was going to be around the baby because her daughter, the baby's grandmother, was going to be watching the child. And she didn't want to get the shot. She didn't understand why she needed it. And I said, well, you can't see the baby. Within 5 seconds, she had her sleeve up, ready to get her shot. So when you put a baby in the mix, people think differently. I've had, you know, patients say, I'm not getting that. I don't need it. Because I think adults sometimes have a hard time comprehending that they still need vaccines. Their vaccines are not just a childhood thing. It's an adult thing. So it's easy for the mom and the dad to buy into it. But I think the grandparents sometimes, you know, they need a little coaxing. And that baby-to-be is coaxing enough little encouragement to get them to get that vaccine. It is all about protecting the baby. And that's how I explain it to the patients. It's not about yourself. It's all about protecting the baby because pregnant women need flu shots. Pregnant women, they check the immune status for measles, mumps, and rubella when women are pregnant just early on because it's all about them being protected so that the baby can be protected.
So if you're going to visit some mother who is in labor, doesn't the hospitals now require some vaccination 2 weeks ahead before, so it takes full power and the patient is going to visit the mother and the baby?
Correct, because they don't want to put the baby at risk. So that's, babies have very limited immune systems. Even though they're roasting for 9 months, they get a lot from the mother, but they have to, when they're out into the real world, then they're more susceptible. And infants get very little vaccines when they're born. When they're born, they get hepatitis B in the hospital, but that's still not protecting them. That's a series of vaccine, and they're not eligible to get their first set of shots until they're 6 weeks. And that's, you know, that's the minimum at this point, with the exception of hep B. So it's, you have to be, as an adult, when you're going to visit an infant, you have to be protected. And, you know, and it's sometimes the parents have to be a little selfish. I mean, I've had some parents to the extreme, you know, especially in the last few years with COVID. You know, they wanted COVID testing done on grandparents, and they wanted all their shots up to date, you know, not just tetanus with the pertussis. They wanted, you know, everything up to date, flu and pneumonia. And so some, you know, that was a little excessive, but I can understand to a certain extent because as a parent, your job is to protect that infant. So that's kind of how all that is more so geared for the baby, not necessarily for the parents.
So Dr. Bradshaw, from just moving on a second here, what about COVID? Is that still been an issue in your patients? We have a new variant out. So far, I haven't heard that much damage. Your uptake.
So what I've seen is that COVID is still an issue. I will say that since March of 2020, there's never been a week go by that I have not received at least one call from a patient saying that they are positive for COVID. So in what I do, it's never not been an issue or never not turned up, but I did see when there were more gatherings, there were more issues with COVID. Thankfully, COVID is not as severe or life-threatening as it was early on. It seems to have kind of quote-unquote watered down a little bit, but it's still affecting patients. I have patients that are getting COVID, and they are sick weeks later. They come into me, and they're still coughing. So they still have some respiratory issues. Some have gastrointestinal issues. So it's still an issue. You know, we are living our lives to our new norm, and people are traveling and visiting friends and family. And by all means, I think that we should. But I just think we have to be cautious. It's still contagious, but those flu and other, especially viral infections. So COVID is still an issue. It has not been eradicated, and that's why, you know, I still see a need for patients to get the COVID vaccine. But I will say that patients are what I call COVID tired. They're COVID fatigued. They're tired. They've heard enough about it, and they've seen enough of it, and a lot of people have had it, and they're like, well, I'm okay. I mean, I had one patient, she was in a couple weeks ago, and she's had COVID 5 times already. So, and now this last time, it's probably had the most, it's not the most severity, but the most more chronic effects, chronic symptoms, and particularly with cough. So it is definitely something that we shouldn't, you know, turn our back on. It's still out there.
So, Josette, the viruses just don't want to go away. But there's another item that just doesn't want to go away in patients when they come to see the doctor, and that's how many supplements they're taking. Do you have any comments on supplements?
So supplements is not something that you're taught in med school unless they're teaching it now. I knew way back when I was at Temple, they did not teach us about supplements. Supplements was something more that you learned about once you got out of med school. If you don't know about supplements, you're going to be approached with it as a provider, because patients they're seeing them, especially since COVID. It amazed me, the uptake in supplements, and particularly vitamin D. And I believe in them to a certain extent. I take supplements. But what I find is that you have to look at the big picture and do everything in moderation. Supplements in no way, shape, or form should be done or taken in place of your medicine. And because I have an open mind, patients often will tell me, well, doc, I'm taking X, Y, and Z. Okay. So a lot of times I'll ask them, so are you taking that? Because especially with vitamin D, I check vitamin D on all my patients. So they'll say, well, are you low, or are you just taking it because you feel like you need to take it? So then that gives me a better perspective when I check their labs and I see a level, and I'm like, oh, well, your level's great, that's fine, or your level's low, then we can adjust what you're doing. But there's a lot of things out there. I mean, there's supplements from A to Z. There's supplements that can affect just every medical condition that, you know, I learned at every system, there's a supplement out there for it. Does that mean that they all work? Not necessarily. But as far as in some, you know, you want to be careful, because sometimes people are taking a lot of supplements and that can interfere with their medication that they're taking. For instance, I've seen this with depression and anxiety. Patients are taking different things over the supplements over the counter, but you have to be careful, because if they're taking, let's say, St. John's wort, but then their doctor or their provider doesn't know that they're taking that, and then they're going to treat them for anxiety or depression, then that can, you know, interfere with what you're trying to do. So, you know, it can be tricky, but it's definitely something that that patients are doing. Like I said, especially since COVID, you're seeing it. You're seeing more of it. I know I'm seeing more of it. I don't know if it's because I do family medicine, and you know, patients usually will come in and they're taking a bunch of other things. And we do try to get that information out of them, because patients are taking, sometimes they're even, not that aspirin is a supplement, but they'll take aspirin for pain, and you won't know that they're on it, but yet then they're anemic, and then they're having a problem because they're taking full-strength aspirin, like a Tylenol, every 3 to 4 hours, and they're not realizing, well, that might not be the best thing for them. Because when they see things that are easily accessible in your grocery stores or your vitamin stores or your pharmacies, then they think that they're okay, and they don't realize that everything out there has a potential side effect or an interaction. So it's better to let your provider know what you're taking than to keep it a secret.
So Josette, the one that gets me going is vitamin D. Vitamin D is very beneficial, and the problem is we want to make sure that patients don't end up with that, losing a few inches and get that bend over look, that quote, Dowager's hump. Mm-hmm. And for me, I always take a look at their serum calcium in the fasting state. You got to mm-hmm. do this fasting. And the mean in the population is 9.6. So my impression is if you are a senior citizen, say over 50, and you're menopausal and your calcium is less than 9.6, I do tend to give them vitamin D supplements. And again, that's also a tip off that maybe they should get a DEXA scan to see how good their bones are, because the first DEXA scan is just a baseline and you have to get the one in 2 years to see if you're going to be a rapid loser of bone. So for me, that calcium is a tip off of should patients be on a vitamin D supplement such as 2000 international units a day, usually at the minimum. And my impression is that it helps keep people away from fractures down the line. You mentioned that you found that vitamin D was very important. Your experience.
So, yes, with the bone, but I think over the years we're realizing that vitamin D affects so many other areas of the body. I've even had patients with headaches, fatigue, that replace their vitamin D, and that's helped with that. I've had some patients, their vitamin D is 9, and normal is at least 30, 35, depending on the lab. So at that point, I mean, at a 9, they definitely, you know, it would be beneficial to have some supplementation there. Now, I've had some patients that they, when they're really low like that, I'll use the high dose 50,000 units once a week. What I found with some patients that they have a hard time remembering once a week. So, I mean, we have lovely cell phones, just about everyone has, with little calendars and reminders. So I tend to encourage patients to use that to help them, you know, stay on track with their meds. But I have seen the benefits with vitamin D. But again, you have to be careful, because that's with a normal kidney, and you don't, you know, because if someone has kidney insufficiency where their kidneys aren't working properly, then that's a whole other realm. So they're great to take, but you also have to put it all in perspective. And bone loss, which you alluded to with the DEXA scans, that's something that you're seeing more of, and a lot of women, you know, once they go through menopause, they're at risk for losing more bone because they don't have the estrogen. So and when you're trying to explain it to patients, well, you know, when they get to the point where they're osteoporotic and their bones are so thin that they're at risk for, have a great increase for fracture, that they're taking medication, but it's all about building bone, cutting back, decreasing the rate of bone loss, but you still need the calcium and the vitamin D to help with that.
Fantastic, fantastic. So let's just jump a second to hormone replacement. You're a gal, and I don't know your breakdown of male-female patients, but I would assume you see a number of menopausal women. We talked about DEXA, if you want to go further, and what about estrogen for middle-aged young ladies?
So that's been something that's changed through the years. I've been in medicine since 96. So in that time, I've seen a shift from, women who are no longer having a regular period, they can take estrogen forever, to now we've got down to, I believe it's 5 years. So when a woman stops having a period, it's a year now, you have to wait a year. Once they go a year without regular menses, then they're considered in menopause. So at that point, and even before they stopped having a period, women tend to have symptoms. So a woman's, the most common complaint that I hear about is hot flashes. And even though a lot of them go to their GYN, and that's changing, so how often they get a pap smear, that now women aren't going to the GYN as much. So I do see a lot of women, well, what can I do about my hot flashes? And they'll ask about estrogen. But because estrogen is getting such a bad rap, I do hear less about what can, you know, can I have estrogen as opposed to, well, what can I do about my menopausal symptoms or what can I do about my hot flashes? So estrogen was the ultimate go-to, but because of the risk for cancer, and that's particularly uterine cancer, then it has decreased as far as what I've seen, the patients that are on estrogen. And if they do, now you do have those patients that they've tried different things, supplements over the counter, and they say, well, none of these are working. You know, I want to do estrogen, because everybody, they go online, they do all their research, they go to Dr. Google, and then they come in, and then they a lot of times patients will ask for what they want. And not that I'm a fan of that, but that's, you know, that's where we're at in today's world. And so some will say, well, I know that estrogen is available, but what they don't understand is the negative with it and what can happen if. So I do explain to them, I explain the good, the bad, and the ugly, and then a lot of times I let the patients, you know, make a decision. I'm not a big fan of it, but, you know, if they choose to, they want to try it for a few years. But my concern is at the end of the 5 years, when you got to get off of it, then there's a concern, you know, weaning them off of it, because they've been hot flash free for this time. Now, if a woman doesn't have a uterus, let's say she's had a hysterectomy, she had fibroids, and she had a hysterectomy, then it is safer for her to be on estrogen. But a lot of times for the woman, it's about treating the vasomotor symptoms. Now, there is something new out on the market that can treat those symptoms and is not estrogen, so that also is another thought.
So I guess the one thing to remember is that that at 60 years of age, I think the general consensus is that gals should be off of estrogen. But there's definitely patients who say, I want my estrogen, that's it, I'll take the risk. Write your note, doctor, that says I'm taking the risk because I have to have a life. Now, do you get any of those patients who want to get estrogens after age 60?
I have not. And if I did, I would turf that off to their gynecologist.
Okay, that's fair enough, for sure. For sure.
I would whoop out then, on that one.
So just, yeah, well, that's okay. But go back to that DEXA scan, because I think that's really important. I mean, you hate to see somebody come in, you know, with 2 inches of height loss. You know, usually if you've lost 2 inches of height loss, those bones are hurting. And some people come in with 3 inches. And so how do you deal with DEXA scanning in women? Are they okay with that? Because Medicare usually pays for that, you know, every 2 years.
They do. So a lot of times I kind of slide that in there with their mammogram. They see the relevance of the mammogram because of breast cancer, and that's every year. But for the DEXA, that's every other year. So once we start checking it, it's just a matter of staying on top of it. And I mean, I am a fan of electronic medical records because it just makes it easier for me to find things, because my charts used to be very, very thick. So when it's just a matter of them going to get it done. And I had a woman just this week who said she would get a DEXA, but she won't get a mammogram. She's tired of being squished. So, and she's 70, 76, 77. So she's due for her DEXA, but she's not doing a mammogram. So I just document in the chart that she declined the mammo for this year, but she's, you know, she's all in for her DEXA. So, you know, we'll see. But it's definitely, I don't have women refusing to get the DEXA scan. I think what more is they don't quite understand the importance of the DEXA scan. So it's more of an education thing. And in family med, I mean, I know all doctors, all specialties have to educate, But I find in family medicine, I was taught that you have to educate your patients, and I still to this day am educating my patients because I don't like to just be an authoritative, I'm the doctor and you do what I say. I want to try to help them understand where my thought process is, why I'm doing this, because a lot of times they don't understand that. And it's, you know, you go to the doctor and, yeah, some want to be told what to do, but some need to understand a little bit more of the hows and whys. So I don't have anyone outright refusing a DEXA scan. I just think they don't understand the importance of it. And I had a patient with a fracture, and she's refused mammogram and DEXA scan for years. I have taken care of her for a long time, and I don't have not one on the chart. But she slipped in her bathroom. She had a fracture. She is, I believe, 72, 73. So her insurance company was bugging me to get her a DEXA scan. And so because of her fracture, she finally agreed to it. Now, thankfully, she had normal bone. Her DEXA scan was normal, but she still had a fracture. So can you have a fracture and have normal bone? Yes. But that one thing now has convinced her to get her mammogram and to get her DEXA scan, both of which were normal, thank goodness.
Well, Josette, she's an awful lucky lady. That's my comment only.
She is, exactly.
Awful lucky. Let's see. Now, let's just switch to a little bit more of a fun topic. What about holiday goodies and gaining a lot of weight? How do you answer that question? You know, because that's one that you take a look at their BMI and they don't know what the BMI means. And they basically don't do that exercise that we talked about, you know, in the beginning, you know, getting that exercise in, and then what's going to happen to their quality of life down the line. So how do you handle holiday goodies?
So this is a time where, I mean, you see diabetics all the time, so I can't say this. You probably can't say this, but I tend to see less of my diabetic patients between Thanksgiving and Christmas, because with that appointment often comes their lab work. And then I see how bad their numbers are or where things need a little bit more work. Just in general, I mean, this is for everyone, whether you're diabetic or not, this is a time of year where we tend to indulge a little bit more. I know for myself, there's certain things that I look forward to that I make at Christmas. So you have to plan accordingly. We should all try to be active. And it can be harder, especially as you get older. Your metabolism slows down. So as you get older, you tend to gain more weight, so you have to increase your activity level, and it's not easy. When you hear 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and it does sound like a lot, especially when you have a busy schedule and you're trying to carve that out, but you have to start somewhere. Try to do 10 minutes, even if it's a walk, like you mentioned earlier, walking versus running. Something is better than nothing. And if you can increase your activity level, then that will help as far as your caloric intake. No, just because you eat more doesn't mean you exercise more and it's all going to negate itself. But if you're doing something, it's better than nothing, because the heavier we are, the more that affects us in the long run, as you alluded to. I was at the American Academy of Family Practice meeting last month, and I went to a lecture on obesity, and they're saying now that obesity is replacing tobacco use in regards to health risk, which blows my mind, because smoking can be so bad for us in regards to cancer and COPD and heart disease. And to think that obesity is now replacing it is something that we can't ignore it. And I mean, I'm you know, a couple months ago, you know, I was inundated with patients that want to be on certain drugs that I don't want to mention because they want to all lose weight. And it's sad because we don't want, some people put in the work and they can't lose weight. But now we're at the point where we don't want to put in the work and we just want to lose weight. And it's even worse at this time of year because of the cookies and the pies and the cakes and the great meals that we had just 2 days ago and the leftovers that we're still eating today, you know, for some of us. So it is something that you have to try to keep in mind. And if you really want dessert, maybe don't have soda or juice with your meal. Have water. We need more water anyway. If you really want dessert, don't have the rolls. You know, carbs are, you know, will do us in. So at the end of the day, you know, you have to look at, you know, how much fruits and vegetables you're eating, as opposed, and particularly more veggies than fruits. You know, so we're at a place right now where you can't avoid the obesity epidemic. It's out there, and in the long run, it's affecting our joints for osteoarthritis. It's sleep apnea, even asthma. And then the diabetes, the high blood pressure, the heart disease. It's affecting so many different systems that we have to pay attention. We have to, and I don't want any, you know, and it's kind of a tightrope walk because I've had patients come to me as new patients because their previous provider never addressed their weight, never told them that they were overweight and they need to work on that and what to do. I've had people come to me because their provider called them fat and they were very upset. So there is a way to approach the subject, and it is something that you sometimes is a little bit of a dance, because you don't want to offend patients, but you do want them to buy in to quote-unquote what you're selling.
So, Josette, let me just move ahead here, because you've got a few topics that we discussed that you were interested in covering for the audience. I've been smoking all my life. Will I benefit from quitting?
The answer is yes. You definitely will benefit. You might not see the benefit right there. Financially, first of all, as expensive as smoking is, and I am a non-smoker, I've never been a smoker, so I don't understand the addictive part of it, but my father was a smoker. And to this day, if I ask him, well, do you miss it? He'll say, yeah, I miss it. But it was affecting his health. So once you stop smoking, your lungs will love you for it, but it is a process. And if you've been smoking for a long time, then you might have damage there that's already done. You know, I've had patients who stop smoking and then they cough more. And they say, well, I cough more now that I've stopped smoking. Well, ultimately, at the end of the day, your lungs have to clear that out. So, yes, if you're a smoker, you should try to stop. It does have bad effects, like was previously mentioned, but it can be of benefit. So even if you smoked for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, it's never a bad time to stop.
So, Josette, let me move ahead. Is Cologuard the same as a colonoscopy for cancer screening? Your take?
No, Cologuard is not the same as colonoscopy, but it has value as a colon cancer screening equivalent. Cologuard tests stool DNA, whereas colonoscopy is actual visual looking at your colon. So, of course, the gastroenterologists who perform the colonoscopies are going to say, no, Cologuard is not good to do. But if you do not have a family history of colon cancer, do not have a family history of colon polyps, then Cologuard is a great way to be screened for colon cancer. And it is approved. Insurances will cover it. You do not have to incur that cost. It's done in your own home. You don't need a prep for it. And it's done every 3 years. I have found 2 people with colon cancer with Cologuard, 12 people with polyps with Cologuard, and I've ordered hundreds of them over the last 3 to 4 years.
Okay. Can I gain weight by eating holiday goodies?
Yes. Yeah. You can gain weight by eating holiday goodies, but the goal would be to increase your exercise and decrease what you're trying not to eat as many of the goodies.
Okay. So what about vitamin therapy? We talked about that a little bit, supplements, but are there any vitamins that you kind of will go out of your way and tell a patient they should take? We were talking about vitamin D.
So I definitely see the value in vitamin D. I have noticed that some people do better with B12, and I actually do check for B12. I do know that some providers aren't as comfortable with different vitamins, but there is some value to that. And you have to go by you, because yes, I can measure vitamin D, and if vitamin D is low, it's good to replace it. But there's not going to be a feel. You might not necessarily, quote unquote, feel better because you're taking those vitamins. I do find that there's a lot of different antioxidants out there that can be helpful. And some people even do well with things like probiotics, because probiotics put good bacteria in their gut, so it helps with their digestion and their stools. So that's another thing to think about too.
So what do you think? Is there value with urgent cares? Because there's a lot of practices now that don't show up on Saturday mornings.
So urgent cares have value. I would not take anything away from it. I would not take that away from them. I think they're great for if you're sick. But there is still value for having a primary care provider. And I'm a little partial to that because I am one, but your primary care provider knows you and they know your family history. That's one of the things I love about family medicine, is you get to know your patient. So at urgent care, they don't know you. They don't know what antibiotics or whatnot works for you. I've worked part-time in urgent care, so I do understand, but I look at it a little differently. But a lot of patients go there when they're sick. They can't get into their own provider. It's harder now to get into your provider, especially since COVID. A lot of providers left the field. So, yes, urgent cares have value. So no offense to the urgent care goers out there, but you still should see your own primary care provider once a year.
So, Josette, you're in the trenches, and a patient comes in and says, "I had some chest pain the other day." When does that get your ears to perk up and say, "Hey, I got to do something for this person to make sure they don't have heart disease"? Just curious how you push the buttons on the patient to make sure if they have heart disease, it's detected.
So I look at the age. The older the patient, the more risk they are for having heart disease. A patient's main concern when they have chest pain is their heart. So that is one, yes, I need to get to the bottom of the cause of the chest pain, but I'm treating that patient. So I have to look at the patient and say, okay, let me just, listen to the story. It's all about the story. You have to hear the story. And because I'm going to do the bulk of my work is when I hear the story and I ask the questions to elicit what's going on. Are they having pain at rest? Is the pain waking them up? Is the pain moving anywhere? So once I try to elicit, okay, is it a cardiac thing? But there could be lots of other reasons on why someone has chest pains. Yes, I want to eliminate a cardiac issue, and oftentimes they'll get an EKG in the office. But if they are, older, have a family history of heart disease, then Do they need to see a cardiologist? Do they need a stress test? You know, once we've eliminated it, that there isn't a cardiac issue and they're still having chest pain, could it be their lungs? Could it be the chest wall itself? So, yes, cardiac is definitely the top of the list, but you have to elicit the story. You have to find out what's going on in regards to this chest pain.
So
a 20-year-old having chest pain. I'm sorry.
So, Josette, do you ever suggest a calcium score for a patient? I know that's money out of their pocket, but if you come up positive, it's definitely money well worth spent. How do you guys handle it?
All the time.
All the time.
I love that test. I love it more now because it's a great – I use it – a lot of the ways that I use it, though, and I don't necessarily use it for chest pain as much as I use it for a patient with high cholesterol, because I'm getting more and more patients that I've been sitting on their cholesterol and I've been trying to get them to take medication and no. So now with this calcium CT scan, I'll say, why don't we get this test and see if you're starting to develop any plaque? And if it's positive, even a little, slightly positive, I haven't had one yet that said no. So, and I have found heart disease from a calcium CT scan. And it personally, in my own husband, and that was, he had very subtle symptoms, did not seem to be cardiac, but I didn't want to address, I didn't want to ignore it. I did a coronary calcium CT scan, and it was markedly positive, and that started the process, and he ended up having heart disease. So I definitely see value in it, and if not for anything, like you said, it gets them into the system to be evaluated. Now, cardiologists, I have found, don't care for the test because, like you said, it's taking money out of their pocket. But if it gets them in there, just like Cologuard gets them in there. I had a patient that refused to get it done, refused a colonoscopy, but did a Cologuard, and she was positive. So she would have never did a colonoscopy. So it still gets them in the door. So the coronary calcium CT scan, I love that test. I wish insurance would cover it more, but it's $100 well spent.
All right, I kind of concur exactly with what you said. Fantastic test. It makes a difference for a lot of people and keeps a lot of people into the system, and it keeps a lot of people from getting a heart attack. I'm with you. So, Josette, I got about two more minutes. Can you just give everybody, how would they get in touch with the Dr. Josette Palmer?
So I have no Bradshaw anymore. Just to be clear, everyone, I'm Dr. Josette Palmer. He knows me when. So I have a practice in Turnersville, New Jersey. The practice is called Happy Healthy You Family Medicine. I was in Glassboro, but I recently moved the practice to Turnersville a year ago, and I am doing family medicine at Happy Healthy You Family Medicine. The phone number is 856-881-5111.
So Josette, what about... I got it. Now that I make sure you got that in, because I think you deserve it. What about joint pain? I mean, I'm not talking about joints. I'm talking about joint pain and family doctor. Give us a little quick insight into
your
position.
Just joint pain. So joint pain can be tough. I see it in the young and old. You have to look at the age of the patient. We're in New Jersey, so you can't ignore the fact that Lyme disease is prevalent here. And I see it every year, particularly in the spring and summer. But is joint pain gout? You have to look at the location. Is it in the foot? Is it in the ankle? Is it osteoarthritis versus rheumatoid arthritis? They are not the same. And it's harder. You can't really detect osteoarthritis in the blood. Rheumatoid arthritis, you can. But when patients come in with joint pain, I get the story, as always. You got to find out the hows and whys. And then I do some blood to determine, you know, the inflammatory markers. Oftentimes they end up needing to see a rheumatologist. and that is their specialty in regards to joint pain. But it's more about getting the story and finding out the hows and whys of what's going on. But there could be many different things for joint pain. Some could be the actual joint itself. Is it a rotator cuff issue if it's the shoulder? Is it a hip issue? Is it a knee issue? As we get older, we're more susceptible to having different things go on.
Josette, give out your phone number, please.
856-881-5111. Happy holidays, everyone.
All right. Thank you, Josette Palmer. Let me say her podcast will be up in about an hour. www.wwdbam.com. Hit Inside Medicine and then look for Josette Palmer. Thank you very much. Dr. Fallon signing off. See you guys next week. Carry on.